When I was growing up, I lived in a small town, and we didn't pay much attention to locks. I suppose my parents probably took care of locking the doors if they decided that it needed to be done. But I remember quite plainly that most of the locks were the old kind where you inserted a key and you could get a skeleton key or a master key at almost any hardware store or 5 and 10. So they didn't provide a lot of security. Later on in my life, I moved to New York City to go to seminary, and I was struck by the, not so much by the contrast, but by the focus on security. You had to buzz your way into the apartment building and be recognized vocally. And when you went inside, there was a lock and another lock and a bar and a chain and a little peephole that you could look through to see who was there to threaten you. And still, I must confess, I don't think people felt altogether safe. Our reasons for locking doors are many. They give us a sense of security, and we hope, at least in some way, that they will keep out what endangers us, at least slow them down, that they will keep people from taking what we treasure out of where we are, and being, generally speaking, they help us to put our minds at ease, to enjoy a certain kind of peace. But these days, we live in a world where it's hard to find that kind of peace or security or comfort. If we hear, as even we did this morning, once again, of people even in worship who are not safe, then we begin to wonder, in fact, and certainly feel insecure about our own safety and security and that of those we love. What indeed will help us not only with that security itself, but with those anxieties and those fears and those things that trouble us, those dreams and nightmares sometimes that we have of what might be, when we see those suffering inflicted on other people and we think to ourselves, that could have been me or mine, that could have happened here as well as there. We are frightened and fearful, like those first disciples when they dreamed, having dreamed so fully of what Jesus would bring and of the triumph and change that he would offer, having had all that taken away with his crucifixion. And now they are fearful, fearful not even so much for Jesus' message, but for themselves. What was to become of them now that they no longer had him to protect them, to guide them, to tell them what to do? When they were cast adrift, in a sense, fearful for themselves. I suspect when they were in that locked room, they were not gathered so much there for worship or sharing the words of Jesus as trying to plan their escape and decide where they might go and what they might do and what would become of them. And to share something else, which is a part of that whole thing which happens when we are fearful, to see who was to blame. They looked at one another and they said, "Surely you stayed. Surely you ran away." And they looked for a while at Judas, but they knew in their hearts that even Judas was not the only culprit in that group, for all had deserted him in one way or another. Even Peter himself had run away and denied him 3 times. And now they were in a position, fearful of what might become of them, fearful and distrustful of one another, and probably even fearful of Jesus, if he should in fact fulfill his words and come among them, that he would say and look at them and say, "You have failed, get away from me. You have sinned, you have fallen short, you have not measured up to what my expectations might be." And so they locked the door. How ironic that they should lock the door in the midst of fears like that. Certainly the great authority of the Romans could have taken care of those doors in a moment. Certainly Jesus himself demonstrated how flimsy that protection was. We don't even hear a description of how he got there. Suddenly he just was among them. And perhaps he always was. Perhaps that's one of the marvels and miracles of this time that they found, is that for a moment, as they gathered, as they drew together, as they looked at one another and shared those frightened glances and that bewilderment, they realized and recognized that Jesus was there. It says that he showed them his hands and his feet. But it was once again one of those terrible times when they were filled with fear. And I wonder, until he did that, whether in fact they did in fact recognize him when he first appeared among them. How often Jesus has done that, as we read in the gospel accounts, when they were terrified. How about that time when they were out on the Sea of Galilee in the midst of a storm and they were afraid of drowning? And Jesus suddenly appears to them, walking on the water, coming near to the boat. It says they didn't recognize him. Recognition seems to be at the heart of our understanding and of Jesus' capacity to reach into our lives, our ability to recognize him present. And he does it seldom in remarkable ways. More often than not, it is in a very common, simple way that he comes to them, as in that greeting which is exchanged in that part of the world almost every time people meet. Shalom, shalom aleichem, peace be with you. About as common as our saying, hello, how are you? And there's Jesus greeting them in their midst, welcoming them, speaking in the midst of their fears. Jesus came to them, and for us, he brings a model of exactly how we might deal with our own fears and our own discipleship, because we no longer have, in the same way that they did up to that point, Jesus among them. We too struggle with what we are to do with Jesus no longer physically present, how we are to fulfill our ministry, how we are to be Christians in the world in which we live, a world which is frequently frightening, which frequently doesn't listen to us or believe, which frequently thinks that we are wasting our time and energy, that our priorities are wrong, that there are many other and better ways to live. And Jesus brings in the midst of that peace. He shows them his hands and his side, and they recognize him. And he says, peace be with you. And then strangely enough, instead of saying, okay, I'm really sorry for you guys, I'll try to cheer you up, he says, okay, that's over. Now, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. Not exactly what they expected, and not exactly what we as Christians expect. When we become Christians, when we are confirmed, baptized or confirmed, or join the church, or begin to study, or begin to pray, we kind of hope that Jesus is going to help us out. And when we're honest, most of the times when we come to God, how do we come to God? God, I need, help me with this, bail me out, make me wise, help me to be understanding, give me more of whatever it is I need currently. But we seldom come to him, okay, Lord, what can I do for you now? And Jesus comes to him, comes to them, and says, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. It's important for us to know what that sending really was, because even being sent can be frightening. If it involved his just, okay, I'm opening the doors, you're no longer allowed to stay here, you're out there on your own. Certainly, like them, we would feel very uncomfortable and abandoned. But that isn't really what he says. What he says is the Father has sent me, so I send you. And how does he send them? He sends them to do the very thing that he did, and he gives them two powerful tools. The first powerful tool he gives them is the power of forgiveness. The power of forgiveness. Think what he says to us in those few words. Sometimes we get misguided, I think, because we look at that in terms of authority. And sometimes there are debates in the church as to who has the authority to forgive sins. Jesus was often challenged on this. And if we think of that just in terms of something, for instance, the priest might, because he's ordained, he has the power to forgive. But that is not restricted to those who are given that kind of official designation. Rather, that is a Jesus giving away the power to each one of us, a power which we always possess. All we have to do is say, I forgive. And we bring by that power such change to the world that we cannot even begin to imagine it. It is why Jesus came. He came bearing the forgiveness of God, but he brought it to us to forgive us that we might likewise forgive. We pray it in the Lord's Prayer all the time. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us, or sins, if you'd rather. I can remember a relative of mine who once came back from church, and they had that passage from Matthew where it goes on to say, for if you don't forgive people their sins, neither will your Father forgive you yours. And I remember her saying, has that always been there? We don't like the idea of having to forgive, because there are always those instances when people do the unforgivable. They hurt us, they harm us, they mistreat us, they take advantage of us, they do things to us that seem totally unforgivable. Sadly, in some parts of the world, all you have to do to be unforgiven is to be different in some fashion, either by religion or color or faith or personality or member of a family or location. Somehow, sometimes even that seems unforgivable if in fact it requires forgiveness. But God says, you are looking at another child of God. How can you who've been forgiven not forgive? So he gives them that power. What a wonderful power he gives. And he gives them an empowerment to do it. We all know forgiveness is very difficult indeed. I've known people in the church. I had a parishioner that didn't come to, he would sit in church. 6 months he was in church after I was there, and he never came to communion. I asked him why. He said, there's a guy at work I can't forgive. And so I know I can't come to God without accepting forgiveness, without being able to forgive him, so I don't come to communion. Well, that's, I guess, a piece of bad thinking. Because if you keep away from God, so because you have been harmed, you're putting up a block for God. And I suppose that is indeed the unforgivable, because you won't let it happen. But letting God bring you that power, the power of God comes through Jesus' presence, first in the world and then in our lives. And it is in that power, the power of his presence, the power he brought to that room, the power to forgive one another, the power to forgive those who even threatened them, this power was one that Jesus let loose. But he brings that power in a very personal way. Thomas was not there. And Thomas said, not me. I am not going to believe it unless I see for myself. So what did Jesus do? He didn't say, okay, guys, bring him in and turn up the volume. He didn't say, okay, do all the demonstrations. He waited till he came and said, Thomas, touch me, see, experience. He personalized that experience for each person. And so it is with the coming of Jesus after the resurrection. For each, in some ways, it is meant to be personalized. Jesus does not simply come and give us the message. He doesn't give us the script. He invites us to be a part of the play, to be a part of that life, which experiences forgiveness, which sees God present, which sees God caring in your particular situation and circumstance, which lets God loose in your life, not just about your life, but in the very life that you live, through presence, through forgiveness, through invitation. The collect that we read today at the beginning of the service says that talks about our practicing what we profess. What a challenging that thing that is. It invites us, as Jesus invited those disciples, to practice what we profess, to let Jesus become a part of our lives, to come into the room, to go forth. When the disciples left Jerusalem, they didn't go out and immediately say, okay, I'm going to go to India, and I'm going to go to Greece, and I'm going to go to Rome. For the most part, they went home. Now, that would seem, on the surface of it, to be kind of strange and commonplace. But the fact of the matter is that is precisely where we begin to practice what we believe, to practice that sense of God's presence, to make God, to acknowledge God's presence in our lives, with our families, in our work, in the things that we do, in the expression of our personalities, in our creativity, even in our eating and sleeping. If we take God, if we invite God, if we recognize that Jesus is already there, then in fact we have the power that he gives through his Holy Spirit to be and to live his presence in the world. Physically, Jesus is no longer present, but we are. And we are therefore his presence, as he was among those first disciples. We are his presence, living out that forgiveness, living out that power, being him in the world. It's an invitation and a challenge. As one of my favorite shows with monks says, it's a blessing and a curse. It's not a curse, really, in this case. It's a blessing and a challenge. We are invited, we are endowed, we're challenged, we're sent to be God's people in the world, but no longer in fear, for it is in the hands of God, the God who raised Jesus from the dead, the God who loves us beyond death, the God who calls us by name. This God invites us to be his people, to live in the world, to live what we profess, to be peace to the world.